You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, in self-isolation with two children under the age of five, my wife and my dog here at the house. Yes, those of you who think I should be finishing my thesis, well, I should be finishing my thesis, but again, with two young children in the house, you know, one of them, school has been cancelled until after Easter break. So this is all quite challenging, to say the least. But what I wanted to say before we go into our segment with Elizabeth Dickinson here on episode 316, she's the senior analyst for Crisis Group, and we'll be talking about Cauca, so one of the most, complicated and complex departments in Colombia, and she's a real expert, and she explains it very clearly what's going on down there. So fantastic episode in the pipeline for you. Adrian Alsimer will not be with us this week because he's just had too much on, and that leads me to why. And why has he had too much on? Well, not only because of COVID-19 and the coronavirus, but also because the top has blown off on a jar of corruption that is just so far-reaching and undeniably worrying for not only the present government, the past government, and the government before it. So we're looking at Duque, we're looking at Santos, we're looking at Uribe, and the connections being made via now deceased Ñeñe Hernández, who is from Cesar and has connections to narco trafficking, money laundering, and so on. And so he is a connection between politicians and drug trafficking in Colombia. And of course, I mean, it keeps coming out. More and more tapes are coming out. But unfortunately, the headlines and, of course, the airwaves are full of coronavirus. So please don't lose sight of perhaps the most important and most underreported internationally corruption scandal outside of Odebrecht to take place here in Colombia and to be revealed in Colombia. And that's why Adrian Alsimer is taking a break this week to continue reporting on that. And I hope to get him on the show, perhaps for next week, discussing Ñeñe Gate. So we'll talk about that later, hopefully, on the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you again to those of you who've pledged money on our Patreon campaign. That's patreon.com, Columbia Calling. For as little as $2 a month, you can ensure that we continue to grow and improve. And also, there's a website called buymeacoffee.com, and you can just pledge single amounts from $5 to $15. A couple of people have already pledged there. So thank you again to those people too. So I know that you enjoyed last week with Matt Rendell. Buy his book, Colombia's Passion, all about cycling. And now tune in to hear Elizabeth Dickinson on the next segment, episode 316, talking about Cauca. So we'll be right back. Please don't go away. And thank you again. Stay safe, everyone. And we're back. This is segment three of episode 317 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I'm here at the offices of Crisis Group in Bogota. And my very special guest this week is Elizabeth Dickinson. She's the senior analyst for Colombia at this entity. And we're going to talk about some of the issues affecting Colombia, the political issues affecting Colombia at the moment. And it's a great honor to be here. Thank you for your time, Elizabeth.
Really a pleasure. Looking forward to speaking.
No, it's fantastic to have you on the show, and you're bringing a wealth of knowledge with you because you've been in the Far East, well, the Middle East, in fact, for almost a decade. You were a journalist as well, and now you're here, and you've been doing a lot of travel around Colombia, and I want to focus on part of the place that you've been a couple of times, I know, in recent months, Cauca. Now, to my mind, Cauca is perhaps the most complex department right now in terms of peace accord implementations, the killing of the social leaders, narco trafficking and various armed groups. Give us a little bit of an overview, if you can.
Sure. Well, I think the story of Cauca in this particular moment
really begins with a contrast between two extremes. When the peace accord was signed with FARC in 2016, Cauca, and particularly the north of Cauca, was one of the regions that saw the largest decrease in violence, so one of the biggest improvements actually in the situation after the FARC demobilized. The FARC had controlled a large number of that territory, a large amount of that territory. The FARC had controlled a large amount of that territory for some time, and when they left, there was a notable improvement. One community leader that we recently met called it a benediction, a blessing for the region after this accord was signed. You compare that, unfortunately, to today's situations, and it's also one of the regions where we've seen the largest deterioration in the security situation. And I think, you know, the sort of storyline here is a question of gaps that were left after the peace accord, gaps in territory, gaps in institutionality, gaps in leadership, and gaps that armed groups were more equipped and more interested in filling than elements of the state or others who would have been able to do so as well. So unfortunately, we've seen today a rise in FARC dissident groups, of which there are at least three operating in Cauca at the moment. The ELN, the sort of remaining leftist guerrilla movement in Colombia, previously had a presence in Cauca, but they have consolidated that significantly. And, I mean, one of the most alarming trends from communities that they described to us was really this sense that they don't know who's who, that there are armed groups in the region that suddenly they can't recognize, they don't know who's leading them, they don't know what they want. So from an experience with FARC, where they always had at least knew who to talk to, what the rules were, what the red lines were, today there's a situation in which they feel that all the rules have been obliterated and it's all bets are off about what's permitted and not permitted in a territory where armed groups are operating. So this has led to a really complex and chaotic, really, situation, particularly for the communities who live there. I think who describe it as one of the worst moments that they've seen in a number of years.
It's incredible. It had the most improvement, obviously, because it was a largely FARC-controlled, let's say that the rural area is largely FARC-controlled. And then for some reason or another, the government didn't move in. I mean, I can't get my head around that. I can't get my head around the whole idea is that, you know, one group would evacuate and then the formal authorities, let's say not the de facto state of the FARC, which was there, the formal authorities should move in and legitimize their situation. You know, let's say put in better communications, transport, healthcare, education, the things that make a community and engender peace, let's say, but they didn't. And so now we're left with, you said, we've got the FARC, we've got three dissident wings, as you say, the ELN, and beyond that, who else have we got there?
Yeah, so beyond that, we also have the EPL, which are also known as the Pelusos. And there are constant rumors about new fronts of FARC dissidents entering or trying to consolidate the different blocs that currently exist. One of the most persistent rumors at the moment is that the Segunda Marca Italia, which is the dissidency led by Ivan Marquez, the former negotiator of the peace accord, who abandoned that process in July. If that were to be the case, if the Segunda Marca Italia really is entering northern Cauca, this could change the dynamics considerably by adding really a much more political element to the dissidence than currently exists. When you ask any community, I think, in northern Cauca today, whether it's the Afro-Indigenous communities or, you know, just local authorities, they will really describe the dissidents today as delinquents, that they lack ideology, that they're a degraded form of the guerrilla movement that they knew for so many years.
Wow. I mean, I had no idea that maybe the Segunda Marca Italia would be there. Ivan Marquez, I knew that he and Jesus Santrich, the two of them who left together, and then obviously went off to Venezuela and were headquartering it there. I mean, I assume they're still headquartering their movement from Venezuela, but I know that he had been sending his envoys to try and link the other dissident groups together to sort of, you know, the revolution continues type thing. But the other factions are not interested. I mean, it's too economically viable, I think. But if they're there, and as you say, it's a political, more of a political element to the situation, then that makes that group maybe, if they are genuinely political, an easier group with whom or with which to negotiate. I mean, but the others, if they're delinquents, there's no negotiating. It's financial. So this leaves that complex situation there. And do we have the Clan del Golfo in there as well, or the Gaitanistas, or whatever they call themselves now?
You know, it's really quite unclear. I mean, there are rumors that they do have a presence, particularly in some of the main urban areas, not where the drugs are produced or trafficked, but where they pass through, sort of the negotiating stations. Okay. I wondered if I could return to something that you mentioned, actually, about what the entrance of this new FARC dissidency would mean for Northern Cauca, which I would frame it really in the context of a crisis in the demobilization process in Northern Cauca. From the very beginning, demobilized FARC commanders have told us that they, and integrants, so down to medium and low level, have told us that they faced enormous pressure from the original dissidents to abandon the process. Okay. So they were threatened, they were harassed, their families were called, and in many cases there was actually active violence against demobilized combatants from the dissidents, who saw them as sort of traitors, or why aren't you joining us, and this sort of logic. I think this was really one of the initial fuels to the fire that fed the dissidency, because there are indications that members of FARC left the process because of those security threats to them and their family. Now, if the Segunda Marca Italia were to enter, there are a lot of concerns among demobilized FARC combatants that this pressure on them would escalate, because there is a sense within this particular FARC dissidency that all those who remain in the process are somehow traitors to that cause. So we've already seen an escalation, actually, in the last 2 or 3 months of threats towards those who remain in the demobilization zones called ETCRs. Mm-hmm. The threats towards them have really exacerbated in recent months, and this may be due to some of these changing dynamics of who's present and who is gaining or trying to take control.
Wow. So we take Cauca then. Of course, it's a lucrative department. It's a coca-growing department. Of course, coca, the plant used to produce cocaine. I guess they're all jostling for control of the coca plantations down there. But, I mean, I would say sort of, FARC dissidents, ELN, EPL, Palusas, as you say, Segunda Marca Italia. Who are they working with? Because, of course, this is, there's a Cauca is a direct passage to the Pacific, and then up through Central America, and then up, I guess, to the United States. Who are there? I mean, I've read, of course, that there's one side is working with the Sinaloa cartel, another with the Nuevo Jalisco. Is there any truth to this, or is it sort of just hearsay at the moment?
Well, let's start with the question of why this is a lucrative department. So there is coca production in Cauca, but actually there's a lot more marijuana production at the moment, which has been a really expanding industry for some time, including before the peace accord. But up to today, the northern part of Cauca particularly has a large amount of marijuana growth. The coca that's coming through Cauca, and the reason that Cauca has been at so much of the forefront of the competition between armed groups, is actually the route.
Yeah.
So the coca coming from the south of the country, places like Caquetá and Putumayo, needs to pass through Cauca in order to go to the Pacific. So this is really sort of a trafficking question, less than a growing question, although, of course, there are some coca plants there as well. Now, the question of sort of who sells to who is really interesting, and it's constantly fluid. So it's hard to pin it down directly. But one of the interesting developments that we've seen in recent months is that there appears to be some sort of operational accord between the three largest dissident fronts at the moment, not to work together, but simply to divide the market, such that one will bring the coca from the mountains, one will bring it across the city, one will bring it to the Pacific, and so forth. And as one local official put it to us, as long as business is good, everyone's friends.
Yes.
So this this sort of apparent accord, it may last a week, it may last a month, but that's sort of the situation at the moment. Now, the understanding from those FARC dissident groups is that they are in some way passing that product to the cartel Sinaloa from Mexico. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether the Mexican cartel Sinaloa is actually present on the ground in Cauca. I've heard it denied. I've heard it sworn to truth. To me, I haven't seen clear evidence of why they would need to be present on the ground in order to make their market work. But in a way, it doesn't matter if they're there physically or if they're just the ones receiving the product, because as the ones who are paying, they are setting the rules. Mm. And the influx of cash and sort of connotations from the behavior of Mexican cartels into Northern Cauca has changed the dynamics of violence, in that it's made it more lucrative to be involved in a dissident or other armed group. And it's made it more acceptable to use forms of violence that Colombia really hasn't seen as much before, but that are present in Mexico.
Okay, so we're talking things like, As unpleasant, I suppose, as decapitations, huge assassinations, torture.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I digress a little bit. I talked some months ago to Toby Muse, the war correspondent, who's just written, well, his book's coming out, I guess, this month or next month, called Kilo, and he follows a kilo of cocaine from its production, but in Catatumbos, and it's the border of Venezuela, all the way up into the United States, and he goes through all of these areas. And he said on that interview, he's like, it doesn't make sense to me that the cartels would sort of take over the business there, but why would, well, they would like to, but these FARC groups won't want it because they'll be giving up their, you know, their actual, let's say, business model. You know, it's a complete change, which made perfect sense, and that's 15 years of research that he's done all around these areas. And so I think you're completely on the mark there. And you've been down there a lot, as you say, and you've obviously, I'm sure you've been in the ETCRs and talked to some of these, the demobilized, reintegrated, I think, reintegrating guerrillas, and of course to social leaders down there who have been trying to work on the situation. What is the overwhelming feeling you get when you're down there talking to people on the ground?
Yeah, it's tense. I think there's really a sense that not only the situation in Cauca, but really the opportunity to make the dividends of the peace accord work is sort of in a critical juncture. It's a moment of crisis, and I think there is a sense that tipping it over one way or another will really be definitive, that there's an inflection point really upon us. I mean, one of the most interesting elements of Northern Cauca that I think is important to mention is the president's... One is the presence of the indigenous community there, particularly the NASA, who have really been at the forefront of violence from armed groups. Mm. In 2019 alone, they saw almost 70 members of their community assassinated, many of them members of the indigenous guard or even their highest level of authorities. One of the reasons, I mean, the context in which this is happening is very interesting. The indigenous community, more than any others in Northern Cauca, really resisted occupation and domination from these armed groups. Mm-hmm. So when they started to see the dissidents coming into their territory, they didn't stand still. They mobilized the indigenous guard. They started apprehending people at entry points. They monitored who entered and left their territory. They arrested people who they thought were involved in some of these movements. And that very, very strong resistance made them a clear target of attack for the armed groups. So in some ways, we can say that those who have faced the strongest violence are those who refuse to just displace or refuse to just submit to these armed groups, but in fact put up a very significant fight. Now, you know, one of the tragedies of that moment in 2019, of this fight that took place, is actually an internal debate within, I think, the indigenous community about whether that was the right decision, given the high toll that it has taken on them in terms of deaths, but also in terms of just their social cohesion, their ability to exist in their territory. And I think we're in a moment of reconfiguration right now for the indigenous community about what is the best way to respond. They certainly will continue resisting. That's very clear. The question is how they can do so in a way that limits the toll on their community so very directly. And this is, I think, something really important to watch, because it also gives examples to other communities in Northern Cauca that see the indigenous as being the most organized, the most capable of collective protection. Afro communities, Campesino communities, they're all watching to see how this plays out.
Right, so that's a very tense situation. Yes, I've talked to a friend from the NASA community on a few occasions. We had one about the agricultural, indigenous, Afro-Colombian, and even coca-growing strikes in the south southwest. We talked about it last year, and it was his explanation went far more than you'd see in the national press and far deeper, because this is the understanding of his community, of course. I keep coming back now. I don't even remember the number of social leaders killed in Colombia. It's over 500. I'm sure it's over 600 now. It's almost one every 2 days. It seems to have fallen off the headlines a little bit, aside from recently the bodyguard of the gentleman in Cali who was killed, and the Minister of the Interior outdid herself again in statements this week and the last week about this. But we know who's pulling the trigger, but who's sending the order? That's the key thing. Where is this coming from? Finding that. That Ivan Duque, President Ivan Duque, last year, after all of these problems in Valle and Cauca and so on, when the geologists were killed and were executed and social leaders were killed and so on and so forth, and then you've got the president saying, oh, I'm setting up a task force to find out who's doing it. We know who's pulling the trigger. We know the sicarios. They're inevitably caught or killed at some point. That's the life of a sicario, a contract killer. But who's behind this? This is, great to send another, 3,000, 5,000 soldiers down there. But if they're not actually, preventing any of this situation, then it's a bigger problem.
So your question of where this is coming from, unfortunately, the answer is from everywhere, which is exactly the problem. It would be great if there was one person who was behind or one explanation behind sort of who's pulling the trigger. But unfortunately, it's really just the whole context combined that's conspiring to put social leaders particularly in the crosshairs of any number of groups, individuals, powerful interests, which doesn't always only include armed groups. These are really the forces at work here. Look, for me, the violence towards social leaders, of which there were 108 at least killed in 2019, this is sort of the pulse of the patient. Mm-hmm. This is the marker that we can take about how things are going in Colombia, and particularly how things are going with the implementation of the peace accord. The fact that this number continues to rise, and it's persistently high, even historically in the last 5 years, indicates to me that things are not going well, that all is not well, that there is a sort of underlying condition here that's causing these spikes of violence. In terms of the government response, I mean, again, the challenge that they have is that this isn't one thing. It's coming from everywhere. It's coming from every direction. Who are social leaders? Let's start with that question. Social leaders are people in their community who advocate for causes that are important to that community. It could be for clean drinking water. It could be for the implementation of the peace accord. It could be a mother who organizes fellow women in her community to resist child recruitment by armed groups. All of these interests that communities are pursuing immediately come into conflict with armed groups. They immediately come into conflict with powerful economic interests. They immediately come into conflict with large landholders. Whatever the issue, there's something fighting against it that's usually more powerful than the social leader. And as you mentioned, because of the sort of ease with which sicariates can be used for violence in this country, unfortunately, it is being employed. And sort of the value on life has been depreciated in many of these cases, such that the social leader is an expendable cost in order to guarantee someone's interests or position. What the government can do in response to this is sort of comes in four steps. I think there's prevention, there's protection of those who are at risk, and then there's investigation. Sorry, three steps. I think in each of those areas, there are clear things that could be done to improve it. What we can say, though, however, is that for the first time in really recent memory in Colombia, the issue of deaths of social leaders is a political issue. it is a change in Colombian society to have a president have to speak about this. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, the president would not even mention this. Mm-hmm. This is not something that would be on the radar. And that indicates a profound change in the voice that civil society has in this country, which is something that we can applaud. It indicates a change in the public dynamic of what they demand in terms of security and in terms of community engagement. Mm-hmm. This is a good sign that we're all worried about this. The question is now, how can we look for concrete solutions? And I think that's a question that many people are working on, and I think there won't be just one.
I really, really appreciate and like that you've moved to civil society in this and the change in civil society, because whatever your thoughts and whatever anyone's thoughts on President Duque, he came into the presidency not understanding this, that civil society had changed, and there had been a kick. I mean, it had been changing in even the years prior to President Santos coming into it. You know, that it's generational shifts, aren't they? And I do discuss this on occasion, but civil society is changing. And just as you say, and it's kind of like the piece that came out, I think it was Gideon Long's piece in the Financial Times quite recently about the Minister of Finance saying that he's going to have to charge 3-4% more tax because the middle class wants more, as more demanding. But that's without recognizing that civil society has changed. We want to see a return on those of us who pay taxes, no? We want to see a return on our tax dollars, tax pesos that go in. Civil society's changed. The killings of and assassinations of social leaders always happened, but it's now we've taken the common enemy out of the equation and we can see it. Unfortunately, I think it's only going to continue at the moment, and it's not something that can be resolved solely by sending more soldiers to an area. That's, as you suggest, one sort of, let's say, of one element of the tripod, protection. But if you're not preventing it from the source and you're not following through on the investigations, as you say, where do we see ourselves? It's civil society is clamoring for greater attention. The government is very slow on the take up. I mean, let's look forward to the next 2 years of this presidency. How do we see it developing?
So this issue of sort of a lack of communication and understanding of civil society, I don't think I would pin it on one person or one government. No. I would actually say that it's a bigger problem than that. The architecture of the Colombian government is not meant to include a voice. Mm. From sort of the rural areas, from civil society groups. And this is just the reality of how the bureaucracy was constructed. It's not the intention of sort of one person or another. And in fact, there are, I think, many trying to fight back against it. But the bureaucracy in Colombia, as many listeners will know, is a force to be reckoned with. Mm. And I think that is a structural issue that really sets the context here. Now, what that means is that historically, communities in Colombia and the government have not seen each other as allies, but rather have seen each other as sort of enemies that are fighting counter purposes. And that is really, I think, in many ways, the first step to changing some of what's happening, particularly in rural areas of this country, where there's always a suspicion that, those who are denouncing are allied with armed groups, a suspicion that's based in, again, a history of mistrust in which there were, armed groups presences in communities that were beyond their control, and during which time the government was implementing a strong security strategy that really aimed to sort of avoid the communities and really just focus on the armed groups altogether. Now, how do we see this evolving? And what can we do particularly about the situation of social leaders? I have to say that I do think that in this government, and particularly parts of this government, certainly not all, there is will and there is interest in tackling this issue. So I actually disagree with the idea that the government is uninterested in social leaders. Mm-hmm. I think that they do want to fix the problem, if for no other reason than because it's become a political issue for them. So they have to fix it. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is approach. And one of, I think, I would point to two sides of the pendulum here. The first is on prevention, which is an area where there really isn't enough focus at the moment, I think, of addressing what are the key underlying dynamics that are driving this violence. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to address those dynamics is the implementation of the peace accord. Why? Because the peace accord imagines solutions to many of the structural issues like land inequality, like a failure of participation from certain parts of society, or a lack of opportunity to participate, rather. The peace accord has answers to this. Mm-hmm. And implementation is hard. It's tricky. It's complicated. It's never going to be straightforward. It's going to be costly. It's going to be, sometimes it's going to fail completely. But unless that happens, we're going to see these trends continue. On the other side of the equation, looking at investigations into cases in which violence does take place, this is another area where I think there's really solid room for improvement. And again, I actually do think that there's political will to do so, to find ways to have a better presence for the judiciary in the territory. I mean, we were in one area recently, and I won't say where, but there were around 10 municipalities that had just one judge. So how can one judge manage cases that are about, you know, land ownership and company registration and assassinations and threats? And it's impossible. Mm. So these sorts of fixing these sorts of structural issues is so important. And I guess if a final point on the investigation issue is that, you know, today very few homicides overall are clarified in Colombia, which means that the impunity is almost complete. We don't want to rank deaths. We don't want to say that social leaders' deaths are more important and should be investigated before other deaths. All homicides should be investigated. Yes. And not only because it's right, but because it can help us understand what's happening. The leaders who are assassinated are living in communities where violence is generalized. Yeah. So in order to understand what's happening to them, why they're at risk, we have to understand what's happening to the communities. And so linking these cases and really prioritizing the whole picture is a very important step that I think can move things forward.
Well, yeah, fantastic. And we're sort of kind of circling around it here and stuff, but are there any glimmers of hope for a region like Cauca? You've been down there and you just say these people are doing the right thing.
I think there are a lot of everyday heroes in Colombia. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people fighting in their communities for what they think can help them in the sense of security, in the sense of access to education and health. And these individuals will always, I think, give us hope. I worry, though, about the support structure that they have. I worry about the incredible risk that they put themselves under. We asked one group of female leaders who was working in the region, you know, what is the toll on your family life? And it was almost a silence in reply. Yeah. Because the answer, we can imagine the answer. We know the answer. Mm. We know that their children are at risk. We know that they are facing enormous challenges just to their very personal security, their ability to operate, their ability to live normal family lives, to have their children grow up with opportunity. All of this is unspoken. Mm. And I think until there is a better support structure around these communities who are sort of, you know, fighting the good fight, if you will, as we all would do for our children, for our communities, it's very hard to be hopeful in this particular moment.
Yeah, well, you make it all very clear. I appreciate this very much, and I know that my listeners do. And finally, one final question. Okay, so let's say that we'll go back to Cauca again. We've discussed social leaders. We've discussed armed groups. What is the relationship that the people in Cauca in these rural areas, you know, have with the military?
Well, for some of the reasons that we discussed just a few moments ago, I think there's mutual distrust, mm-hmm. huge mutual distrust. Again, the military has long believed that communities are not their advocates, are not allies of security, but rather actually have the enemy within them. And from the other side, I think communities do have a sense that the military is not there for the right reasons, that they are there in ways that are not productive to the community. And communities tell us, in fact, that when Communities tell us, in fact, that when the military is present, it's like putting a giant X on their houses for armed groups who see them as collaborators. So they don't want the military there for the mere reason that it makes them look like they're sapos, like they're informants to the military. So this are really, it is a really complex dynamic. I also see this as a major area where there could be enormous room for improvement in sort of just breaking the ice between communities and the military. But unfortunately, I think it would require a shift in focus from the military strategy, from one of countering armed groups in terms of results, in terms of seizures of drugs, in terms of numbers captured, and moving more towards a model that, that focuses on protection of communities. They're very different models. Yeah. They imply very different types of operations. And I think at the moment, we're probably leaning a little bit too close to the security side and a little bit too far from the community side, in a way that's making this tension and this distrust a little bit worse. I want to say one thing about my previous answer too, about a lack of hope. Let's not say this is hopeless, though. This has been the answer in Colombia for way too long, from the elite, from the leadership in the government, not this government, I'm talking about all governments, that, you know, these areas are hopeless, that they have, there's no way to fix them, that's just how it is, they'll always be violent. No, that's not the answer. We saw in 2016, Cauca can get better. There is an opportunity. So what it takes is getting past this idea that a place like Cauca is unsolvable and then looking for concrete ways to fix it.
I like that very much. I like that. And you know, you have a lot of experience, you know, a decade in the Middle East. If we were to take a model of, and this is my final question and you can go, if we were to take a model from somewhere else, to say, let's move the military towards, you know, a little bit away from security. Let's not ignore security, but towards a community, let's say, model. Is there somewhere in the Middle East that we could look at for as a, or somewhere that you've known or studied would say, this would be the best model for Colombia? Middle East is a really, I mean, that's a hard one.
I'm afraid you've given me an impossible question there, yeah? You know, I think, looking for models might fall into a tendency of exactly what the problem is, the thinking there are quick fixes. And, you know, in Colombia particularly, this is really true everywhere, but I think in Colombia particularly, because of the diversity of the regions and the diversity of the context in which not just each department, not just each municipality, but each vereda, each neighborhood is living in, they really sort of need their own formulas. And, you know, I think this is actually something that's beginning to filter into the thinking, particularly about implementing the peace accord. Some of the initial projects that attempted implementation, for example, with coca substitution, sort of attempted this. Let's apply a template and come in and we'll sort of make it accessible to all. And I think there is a realization in that program, particularly, but elsewhere as well, that this is not going to work. That there are things that make a project viable in one area that will be completely out of context in another place. So I guess I would be really an advocate for starting at a local level, which is where I think really the peace agreement can work best. Again, as we said, you know, communities know what their interests are. They know what's best. They know who's around. They know what the security dynamics are. And they're willing and interested in implementing the peace accord. They're interested in rural reform. They're interested in the development that the peace accord imagines. And I think starting at this local level and empowering and valuing that local level is an important step to understanding what can make things work in the big picture.
Fantastic. And I like that, you know, the community level piece, I think that's so important. I did hear it spoken about a lot by... I can't even remember his name right now, but Sergio Jaramillo, he spoke a lot about that in the, during the peace accord, and it sounded, and we know it's not one size fits all. We know it's not. And as you say, each vereda, each town, each hamlet, each everything, there are different dynamics to each one that need to be taken into account. And of course, if you've got a region like Cauca, as you say, is a main transshipment point for coca paste, cocaine,
some production, and then so many different groups all sort of again looking for control, and the military trying to find a way in there, and the politicians, and it's a difficult one. And thank you so much for your time and the clarity with which you have spoken about a situation which is not at all clear. I know that my listeners will have enjoyed this interview, this conversation very much. And you know, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Columbia Calling.
Thank you. Look forward to speaking again, I hope.
We will speak again, definitely. And you know, there are many more parts of Columbia to explore, and not just on a... You know, not just for work, looking at the, let's say, more nefarious situations of what are going on in Colombia, but there are other places as well that we can enjoy in this country. And I just think that that's a really fantastic summary of what's going on. We could go on for hours, I think, but we can't. And so let me take this moment to say thank you so much to the Crisis Group's senior analyst for Colombia, Elizabeth Dickinson, for her time on the Colombia Calling podcast this week.
Thank you.
And that is me signing off, Richard McCull, for the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 317. It's been an excellent, excellent interview this week, and I know you've enjoyed it. Of course, sign up for the Patreon campaign and support us to help us grow and improve. That's patreon.com. Look for Columbia Calling. We'll be back next week with someone else talking about something very interesting to do with Columbia. As so often is the case, Columbia is the lens for greater conversations about what's going on in the region. But anyway, thank you for listening, and bye-bye.